From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Two men were released from prison this week after serving 17 years for a murder they didn't commit. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Reverend James McCluskey, the man responsible for reopening their case. Since 1980, the Reverend has helped free a dozen innocent prisoners. Also, investigating the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We talk with Natalie Robbins about her new book on the FBI's surveillance of American writers. Through the Freedom of Information Act, she got the FBI files of close to 150 writers. And David Cale performs an excerpt from his show, Deep in a Dream of You. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton is under scrutiny again. Today he responded to a New York Times report that said he worked to exempt himself from a state ethics code. Clinton calls the charges dead wrong. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Clinton told reporters today that it was completely untrue that he engineered a state ethics code so that the governor and other elected officials would be exempt from a disclosure law.
It's just false. It's just dead false. Nobody ever even discussed that issue. None of the good government groups ever even thought about it. Nobody ever brought that up. I tried to pass the bill in itself. If I wanted to get myself exempted, why would I have ever tried to pass the bill in the first place?
Clinton pointed out that the article made no mention of the fact that he himself carried the bill, called a special session to pass it, and was widely praised by public interest groups for his efforts. He said the clause, which involved disclosure requirements for appointed officials in state agencies and commissions, was dropped because it would have been an easy target for those who were lobbying to kill the ethics code legislation entirely. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in New York.
The New York Power Authority today canceled a contract to buy electric power from a controversial hydroelectric project in northern Canada. The James Bay Hydroelectric Project has been opposed by environmentalists and Canadian native peoples who claim that it would devastate a vast area of northern Quebec. New York would have been the project's largest foreign customer. The contract was canceled on the recommendation of New York Governor Mario Cuomo, who said that the state's conservation measures have made the purchase unnecessary. The Massachusetts legislature is also considering a measure that would limit any purchase of power from the James Bay project. German Chancellor Helmut Kohl is being sharply criticized for welcoming Austrian President Kurt Waldheim to Germany today. Barbara Howard reports from Berlin.
Kurt Waldheim, a former German army officer accused of Nazi crimes, is on the U.S. Justice Department's watch list and is barred from entering the U.S. Since revelations about his war past surfaced 6 years ago, no Western political leaders have held formal meetings with him until today. Today, a smiling Chancellor Kohl extended a welcoming hand as Waldheim stepped off his plane onto a red carpet in Munich. The meeting has met international criticism. The World Jewish Congress, among other groups, has condemned it, saying it shows, quote, shocking moral insensitivity to matters of concern to Jewish people and to all people who were involved in the events of the Holocaust. Told of the criticism, Kohl responded, quote, I, as the federal chancellor, decide whom to meet here in Munich. I don't need any advice. For National Public Radio, I'm Barbara Howard in Berlin.
The Dow Industrials lost more than 36 points today to close at 3,231. This is NPR. The parents of a baby born without a fully formed brain asked an appeals court today to allow them to donate the infant's vital organs to other children. A lower court ruled yesterday that the organs may not be donated until the child is declared brain dead. By then, however, doctors say the organs will have deteriorated and it'll be too late to donate them. The baby, a girl, was born March 21st with a little-known condition in which the brain fails to develop beyond the stem, which controls breathing and heartbeat. Doctors say the baby has only days to live. In Cambodia, guerrilla and government military commanders met but failed to agree to stop fighting in the central province of Kompung Tom. Khmer Rouge guerrillas have largely ignored a 5-month-old peace accord in their quest to capture new territory there. Mary Kay Magstad reports that the ongoing disagreements are holding up the deployment of UN peacekeepers.
In 13 years of civil war, fighting in Kompung Tom has rarely been more intense. More than 2,500 civilians have had to flee their villages in the past month because of fighting. Dozens more have been killed, wounded, or taken prisoner by the Khmer Rouge. The Khmer Rouge are defying not only the peace accord they and other Cambodian leaders signed 5 months ago in Paris, but also a two-week truce they agreed to only last weekend. A two-hour meeting today amongst Cambodian guerrilla and government military commanders made little progress towards stopping the fighting. A lower-level meeting will be held tomorrow. The commander of the UN peacekeeping mission in Cambodia, Lieutenant General John Sanderson, said UN troops will be ready to go into Kampong Tom as soon as a ceasefire agreement is reached. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
The UN Security Council decided today to maintain its economic embargo against Iraq, saying Iraq has failed to meet the conditions of the Gulf War ceasefire. The decision came as part of a regular review of the sanctions. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After 17 years in prison for a murder they didn't commit, Clarence Chance and Benny Powell were released earlier this week in Los Angeles. It was very moving to watch them on TV as they described how it felt to be free. My guest, Jim McCluskey, is the man most responsible for getting their case reopened. He also won the release of 10 other wrongly convicted people. McCluskey is the founder of Centurion Ministries, which works to free and vindicate innocent prisoners who are serving life sentences or facing execution. It's a small nonprofit group based in Princeton, New Jersey. McCluskey is a minister, but his typical day is like a private detective's. He tracks down witnesses and other leads, sifts through court records, looks for new evidence, and convinces witnesses who lied to come clean. Obviously, the most gratifying part of his work is seeing innocent men like Clarence Chance and Benny Powell win freedom.
Well, it just doesn't get any sweeter than this because not only are they freed, but they're vindicated, they're exonerated. A judge has, and the district attorney has declared them innocent. So this is, it's the culmination, it's the fruit of the labor, the culmination of a lot of hard work by a few people, and just to see those men in that courtroom free at last, it makes it all worthwhile.
I know you get thousands of letters from inmates who say that they are innocent and they'd like for you to reopen their case. How did you get this case?
Clarence Chance wrote us a letter in April of 1987, 5 years ago. And in that letter, he indicated he had read an article in Ebony Magazine, the March 87 issue of Ebony Magazine, which detailed how we helped free another innocent man by the name of Nate Walker. And Clarence in his letter said, "I'm another Nate Walker, but I'm in California. Can you come out and help me? I know that we're far away from each other, but I'm an innocent man. I was in jail when this crime occurred." So Kate Germain, my assistant, who plucked it out and brought it to my attention, we talked about it, and we said, look, if somebody's telling us he was in jail and he wasn't in jail, then he's got a lot of moxie, but this is something we might be able to focus in on. So it came out that way. We developed a correspondence with him for a year, and then by the time I interviewed him, I had a chance to review the trial transcripts and was very familiar with all the details of the case. And I asked him a ton of questions in a 3 or 4 hour interview at Folsom Prison and walked away very impressed with him, his story, and the fact that he very well could be an innocent man. And I decided to take his case on.
It sounds bizarre that someone would be in prison during the period they were accused of committing a crime, but he was actually just briefly in prison, and he was released later that day. So what was in question, in part, was what time he actually got out.
That's the point. It came out at trial that he began his out-processing from the Los Angeles County Jail. In other words, he was authorized to be released. And then from that moment, it takes usually 3 to 6 hours for an inmate to literally walk out the door. The murder occurred 2 hours after he was authorized to be released, and the murder scene was a half hour away from the jail, and he didn't walk out of that jail about 8 or 9 o'clock that night.
Now, I know one thing you're always suspicious of is jailhouse informers. There was one in this case. What is a jailhouse informer?
A jailhouse informant is a criminal who is in jail for, obviously, his own crimes, usually awaiting disposition of his own crimes, and he comes forward in some manner and is introduced usually as a very important witness for the prosecution, and he comes into the courtroom and tells the jury that the defendant confessed the crime to him while they were together in the local county jail. And we run into this so often throughout a number of cases across the country. It's a common tool used by the prosecution when they have a weak case and they shore it up by going to their ace in the bullpen, but this time not a baseball bullpen, but the local county jail bullpen.
And what does the informant get in return? Reduced charges, or they get off?
The informant gets a non-custodial sentence, or his charges are dismissed. Somehow he's given the gift of freedom, which is the most precious gift any of us could care to receive, and that's their incentive to come in and give false witness for the prosecution.
So how did a jailhouse informant come into play in this case?
Well, this particular jailhouse informant was a man by the name of Larry Wilson. He's the only Caucasian in the whole case. The victim and the defendants and all the witnesses were black. But anyway, Mr. Wilson, a former deputy sheriff in Los Angeles, was convicted of murdering a businessman who he was trying to scam out of hundreds of thousands of dollars in June of 74. So he is now convicted of murder. And all of a sudden, between June of 74 and January of 75, a six-month period, he alerts four or five different law enforcement agencies, including the Los Angeles police, that nine different inmates in nine different cases have lined up to his cell confessing their crimes. Benny Powell was one of them. He says that Powell confessed the crime to him while they were in jail and came in and told the jury that story. What the jury didn't know, what the defense didn't know, and what the prosecution didn't know, but the Los Angeles Police Department did know and suppressed and hid, was that Mr. Wilson, prior to giving his first statement against Benny Powell and Clarence Chance, had told the police that two other men had confessed to the same crime. Then he flunked two polygraphs about two other cases who he allegedly received confessions from, and he also flunked two hypnotic sessions about this particular case.
Well, this guy would be hearing more confessions than your average priest does.
Well, that's why. I mean, they call me the reverend, although I'm not an ordained reverend, but he should be wearing a collar. As a matter of fact, he doesn't even have to wear a collar. He just sets up shop in his cell, and the way he tells it, everybody can't wait to get to him to confess their crimes.
There were witnesses who changed their testimony after testifying against Chance and Powell. And these witnesses said that they were pressured by the cops to identify Chance and Powell. What kinds of pressures did the police exert?
We're talking about a 14-year-old girl and a 16-year-old girl who were two of the main witnesses against these two men. Both of these girls at that time were convicted for a robbery as teenagers. The 16-year-old was sent to jail for it. The 14-year-old was on probation. The police threatened the one in jail that she was going to stay in jail and never see the light of day unless she told them what they knew she knew, namely that Benny had somehow confessed the crime to her, a 16-year-old kid. And the 14-year-old who was out on probation on that same crime, they told her they're going to put her in jail unless she told them what they knew she knew, which she didn't, but which she told them anyhow, that Clarence and Benny had confessed the crime to her in some manner. So they got the message. They were scared to death. And to stay out of jail or to get out of jail, they came forward and much against their will, they told the jury lies so they could stay out of trouble themselves.
What did you do to get the witnesses to tell the truth?
Well, it's a long process in that, first of all, you have to find them. And it took a while. We combed the streets of South Central Los Angeles and the Tenderloin District of downtown Los Angeles, where we eventually found them. When what happened was that we approached Bernadine Kelly first, because she was the first one we found. Coincidentally and luckily, her common-law husband, when we knocked on the door, she wasn't there. But we knocked on the door and introduced ourselves to him, and he had heard of Centurion Ministries because he was in the Harris County Jail in Houston when we freed Clarence Brantley in Texas back in 1990. So when he heard who we were and what we were doing, relating that to the Clarence Brownlee story, he became our ally. And because she trusted him, obviously, he helped her begin to trust us. We were going to listen to her and genuinely interested in what she had to say for the first time in her life. Somebody wanted to hear what the truth was in this case. And she, as did the other witness, Tammy Jackson, they felt terrible for lying against these two men and sending them away to prison than they had been in prison for all these years.
What contact have you had with the officers who coerced these false testimonies?
Well, the two officers are Lieutenant William Hall, who is now in a very senior influential position within LAPD, in that he is in charge of investigating all incidents where a Los Angeles police officer fires his gun. I called Lieutenant Hall several years ago several times, and he knew exactly who I was and what I was doing, and he never returned my calls. The other officer, unfortunately, had a complete nervous breakdown in the late 1970s. He's in Idaho. We went over to Idaho to visit with him. Paul Henderson, my associate, did that. And we were told by his daughter that he was a broken man and in no condition, nor was he interested in speaking with us, and so we let it go.
Gee, so you think his nervous breakdown had anything to do with his techniques as a cop?
I am told by people who worked with Investigator Knott, the man who had the nervous breakdown in the late 1970s, that the primary contributing cause to his nervous breakdown was the pressure put on him by an obsessive zealot supercharger lieutenant who was in charge of this particular investigation by the name of Salvino. Salvino himself was drummed out of the Los Angeles Police Department in 1982 for being, quote-unquote, unfit to command. What happened that forced him to be forced to retirement on his part by the senior echelon, Darrell Gates of the police department, was that four homicide detectives came to their commander and expressed concern that because of the way Salvino forces them to do and how he manages their investigations, they're afraid they might be brought up on both criminal and civil liability charges. And all these complaints coalesced and accumulated, and finally Salvino was forced to retire.
My guest is Jim McCluskey, founder of Centurion Ministries, which works to free from prison those who are completely innocent of the crimes they've been convicted of. He concentrates on people who are on death row or serving life sentences. And he's behind the reopening of the cases of Benny Powell and Clarence Chance, who were freed this week after serving 17 years for a murder they didn't commit. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim McCluskey, founder of Centurion Ministries, which works to free the wrongly convicted. Everyone says, oh, there's no guilty people in prison. Everybody in prison says they're innocent. But I know on Nightline the other night when Chance and Powell were on, one of them said, it's very unmacho to claim your innocence in prison unless you're really innocent. Is that your experience?
Well, that's part of it. When I first was introduced to the world of prisons and the criminal justice system in 1980 as a seminary student at Princeton Seminary, I was a volunteer student chaplain at Trenton State Prison. So I ministered or visited with, I probably met, I don't know, maybe 50, 60 inmates, and only two told me that they were innocent. A number of the other ones were telling me too much of the details of what they did. I didn't really want to hear that, to be honest with you. So to say that, first of all, that everybody says they're innocent in prison is just, it's a myth. It's simply not true in my experience. And what happens is if you're an inmate, inmates are tougher on other inmates than we on the outside are on them if they're proclaiming their innocence. If you proclaim your innocence in jail, you get derided. You get mocked. And sooner or later, you just stop saying you're innocent because nobody wants to listen to that because nobody cares to believe you. So they don't say it. And it's just wrong.
I'm interested in you and how you got on this mission. I know you'd been a management consultant specializing in U.S.-Japanese relations, conservative Republican, house in the suburbs, I think. You've said that you quit that life because you felt selfish. What was the turning point?
I was a businessman, and I guess by those standards, I was successful, making good money. But at the same time, it was an empty life. I was serving only myself. I felt that it was a false life, inauthentic. And so my Christian faith started to take root, and it got to the point where I decided that it was time for me to go out and serve others rather than serving myself. And I do feel called by Christ to leave the world and go into his work, and I had no idea this was where it would eventually take me, though.
So you went to Princeton Theological Seminary, and while you were a student, you volunteered at Trenton State Prison. Is that where you got the idea to do this kind of work?
Yeah, it wasn't really, yes, that's true, but I didn't get an idea. I mean, I went to Trenton State Prison, and as a student chaplain, and one of the 40 men or so that I was visiting by the name of De Los Santos, he was proclaiming his innocence and challenging me that you say you're a Christian, I'm telling you I'm innocent. Isn't there anything you can do for me? And eventually, after speaking with him at length, I got hold of his trial transcripts, came to believe in his innocence. Now what am I supposed to do? I have before me somebody who I never dreamed would be standing before me, a man in his 5-by-7-foot cell, doing life for murder. I have come to believe in his innocence, and what can I say to him? I just can't say, well, have peace, and I'll pray for you. So I felt compelled that I had to do something. So I took a year off from school, from seminary, and went to work on his case. And 2.5 years later, we freed him and exonerated him. And in the interim, while working for him and finishing my studies at the seminary, I met two other New Jersey lifers in whose innocence I had come to believe by the same process, reading the trial transcripts, studying all the facts of the case, asking them many, many questions over many, many months, and then coming to that conclusion. So when Mr. De Los Santos was freed in July of 1983, I finished my education at the seminary, and instead of going on to be a church minister, I decided to set up shop in Princeton and form Centurion Ministries and start work for these other two innocent New Jersey lifers.
Do you have to be tough to not be conned by people who want you to work for them?
Yes, I think people say to me, they say, not understanding what our approach is, of course, they say, well, you're just naive. You're a bleeding heart liberal. You're naive. You believe these cons. Cons are always conning, and you're a sucker. And I say to them, all right, you think I'm naive. I was naive before I started this work, thinking that there were no innocent people in prison. And if there were, they'd be just an isolated incident. But you're naive for believing that the criminal justice system works as almost flawlessly as you think it does. You're absolutely naive and ignorant. And I have come to see this world of criminal convictions with far different eyes than I had imagined before I knew anything about it when I was a businessman.
When Chance and Powell were released this week after serving 17 years for a murder they didn't commit, one of them said he hadn't lost his faith in God, but he had lost his faith in the criminal justice system. Is that the kind of attitude you encourage the people you work with to have, to still have spiritual faith, even though they might have lost their faith in the system?
I'll be honest with you, that depends. I don't push. First of all, it matters not a whit to me if the people we work for and all those who come and work with us on their behalf, I don't care if they what their religion is, whether they're believers or non-believers, whether they're Muslims, it absolutely makes no difference to me. So I certainly don't push my spiritual views on anyone else. And in a natural course of conversation over years with people, it certainly comes up for discussion. But I don't push my views, and We'll discuss it as it seems appropriate.
Has the work that you've done challenged or reinforced your faith?
The ironic thing. I like to think that it is the work of Christ and God that I'm doing. But what I've noticed in the last several years is that even though I like to think I'm doing the work of God, my spiritual life is not as strong as I would like. In other words, I find I'm drifting away from my prayer life is not good. I don't read scripture like I used to. I'll go over to the Princeton University Chapel to sit and pray at lunch hour, and all the while I'm thinking of this case, that case. Here's what I have to do. I better get back to the office right now. So I don't like that, and it's something I have to work on to rebuild my meditative life.
I really understand what you're saying. You're just so obsessed with your work and with the mission of it.
That's right.
So you're going to try to clear your mind a little bit and open your mind more toward spiritual thoughts? Is that what you're
saying? Yes. I am not doing what I know I should do, and that is take the time and go back and reinvigorate my prayer life, my scriptural read. I get great sustenance when I read the scriptures and take quiet time and do that. And when I don't do that, I find myself not drifting away from God. And it's not good. It's not healthy. So I have to get somehow off this fast track, this whirling train that I'm on. You know, I leave Los Angeles on Tuesday, and then a week later, I'm in Grundy, Virginia, working on a death row case I've been working on for 4 years, and the guy has an execution date of May 20th.
Wow.
We're up against the wall.
Yeah, sure. So you're not going to feel very good about taking time off to pray.
Not really. Yeah. Not really.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was reading about you, and it said that after the first person who you got off, you went out with them for some ice cream or something, and then went home to your room where you lived alone and drank alone till 3 a.m, bourbon and 7 Up. And it sounded like a pretty lonely way to celebrate. And I wonder if things have changed a lot on that end.
Well, unfortunately, no. That did happen. I took Mr. De Los Santos and his wife up to the projects in Newark where they lived and dropped them off and then went home and experienced what you just described. But it's not all that sad. I have a lot of... I'm a bachelor. I've never been married. And the way things are going, it doesn't look like I ever will be.
I didn't mean to say it's sad to be single, by the way.
What's that?
I didn't mean to say it's sad to be single.
No, I know. But just to be alone in a situation like that at a time of great joy, I can recognize that that's kind of sad. I'm the first to admit that my life is completely absorbed in the work that I do, and it's completely out of balance. There's not much of a personal life that I have. And I, as much as I would like to, I don't find it's too easy to develop that. But I'm not complaining either, because I consider myself to be the luckiest person in the world, because I'm doing work that I love. It fits my human personality, my human peculiarities. I found my niche in life. And I think it has some redeeming purpose, whereas my former life had very little redeeming purpose. And I feel as if I'm on a mission, and it's a mission that that suits my personality and my sense of what God would like me to do.
Well, I want to thank you, and I also want to say congratulations, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Jim McCluskey is the founder of Centurion Ministries, based in Princeton, New Jersey. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the FBI's surveillance of American writers. Through the Freedom of Information Act, Natalie Robbins got the FBI files on close to 150 writers, writers living and dead, liberal, radical, and conservative. Robbins analyzes the files in her new book, Alien Inc., The FBI's War on Freedom of Expression. Also, looking back on love, David Kale performs an excerpt from his show, Deep in a Dream of You. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials of the Bush administration have announced plans for the U.S. to buy about $14 million worth of Soviet space technology from Russia. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The White House is promoting this sale as the opening of expanded trade between the former Soviet republics and the United States. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the Pentagon will buy the Russian Topaz space nuclear reactor, a small amount of plutonium-238, and four Hall thrusters, devices used for propelling objects in space, such as for turning a space station. Fitzwater said the administration is also working to remove barriers to commercial imports of non-military items, although he was not specific. All of the items being purchased represent technology not yet fully developed here in the United States or is cheaper to buy from the Russians. The purchase is also part of a larger economic aid package the administration has been working on. Fitzwater said an announcement on stabilization of the ruble will be coming. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
In New York City, the UN Security Council has decided to continue its sanctions against Iraq after a routine review of the curbs imposed after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. These sanctions have been reviewed every 60 days since the approval last spring of a ceasefire resolution that called for getting rid of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, along with other demands. On Capitol Hill, the Senate last night approved spending another $25 billion on the savings and loan cleanup. A similar measure is pending in the House, but a political dispute may delay final passage of the measure, causing a break in the cleanup program. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
House Republicans are opposing spending more money to shut down troubled SNLs unless some money is also allocated to keep some troubled SNLs open. Florida Republican Bill McCollum advocates spending $2.5 billion to keep some 53 thrifts in business. He rejects charges the funding would benefit SNL stockholders.
They don't get anything from this. They simply get the institution to stay open. The people who benefit from this are the taxpayers, because the taxpayers literally will save about $25 billion, with a B, billion dollars.
McCollum and other Republicans say unless the cleanup bill contains their provision, they won't vote for it. And Democrats have warned President Bush that they won't vote to continue the cleanup unless Republicans join with them. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
According to news reports in Moscow, a passenger plane was able to land safely after being hit by a heat-seeking missile fired from Azerbaijan. The missile reportedly did not explode but damaged one engine. Some of the passengers on the plane were said to have suffered minor injuries. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 36 points to close at 3,231. This is NPR News. Yugoslavia officials in Bosnia have called for UN aid to stop the ethnic fighting in the region. Because of new violence in the area, deployment of UN peacekeeping troops to Croatia could be delayed. While the first members of the UN team have set up bases in Bosnia, they have not been deployed there. And a government spokesman said the situation is growing worse. He also warned that fighting could lead to civil war that could spread to other parts of the country. Democratic presidential candidate Jerry Brown continued to go after the labor and college vote during a campaign swing today in Wisconsin. Brown drew his largest crowd of the day at a university speech in Milwaukee. Chuck Quambach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Speaking to about 1,500 college students, Brown polished his image as a political outsider. Several times he criticized Congress including for yesterday's failure to shift billions of dollars from defense funds to social programs.
It's not the military budget that they figured out a couple of years ago. They got to crack it open, and let's start building America and our families and our employers.
Brown also said the federal government is not providing enough student loans and health care. Tonight, Brown and his Democratic opponent, Bill Clinton, will meet in a televised forum and answer questions from small-town Wisconsin residents. Then tomorrow, Brown has rallies scheduled in northern Wisconsin. The state's primary is April 7th. For National Public Radio, this is Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
The government says that both personal incomes and consumer spending moved up last month. The Commerce Department says that incomes were up 1.1% and spending was up 1%. The increases in spending in the first 2 months of the year are in contrast to a government report of yesterday that indicated personal consumption was flat. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. William F. Buckley has one. So do Gloria Steinem, Norman Mailer, and Arthur Miller. F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, Dashiell Hammett, Eugene O'Neill, Dorothy Parker, James Baldwin, E.B. White, Annis Nin, even Dale Carnegie had one. What have they all got? FBI files. Files started simply because these writers were saying or doing things that interested the FBI, often things the FBI considered subversive. The first FBI files on writers were opened in 1911, but most of them were opened under J. Edgar Hoover's tenure, which began 6 years later. Through the Freedom of Information Act, my guest Natalie Robbins got access to 148 files on American writers. Those files, along with many interviews, are the basis of her new book, Alien Ink, The FBI's War on Freedom of Expression. She started working on the book by requesting the files of 150 writers from the FBI.
2 weeks later, they wrote me and said that I had to put the date of birth, the date of death, and I had to take out all the living writers I had on the list, because living writers have to request their own file. Eventually, what I did was ask a group of living writers for their FBI file, either to give me ones they had already ordered for their own purposes or to start the process from the beginning and order their file. In any case, I sent my list back to the FBI, and the files started arriving. About a year into my research, when they saw how many files I was requesting, they evidently put two or three people in different desks just on my request alone. In addition, they lowered the fee for me, because it's quite expensive ordering the files and paying for the reproduction of the files.
Gee, that's awfully considerate, don't you think?
Yes, I was very impressed. They reduced the fee by 60%. In, I would guess, almost 80% of the cases, because no one else had requested these files before.
I have to say, I'm surprised to hear about this kind of consideration and cooperation.
Yeah, I would say the cooperation level was almost 100%.
So what was your strategy in deciding which writers' files to request?
My strategy was to ask for just about every person I could think of that would have one, and that's exactly what I did. And I included some that turned out not to have files, though in many cases I am a little suspicious by the answer that they don't have a file. For instance, I was told Jack Kerouac does not have an FBI file, which I really find incredible, since his name is indexed in Allen Ginsberg's file. So it's quite certain that either his file is under another name or for some reason it couldn't be located.
Give us a sense of what the files look like, how they're arranged.
Well, when you receive them, they're either in a small folder clipped together, or they're in a huge box, for instance, or in many cases, many boxes. Walter Winchell's file is almost 5,000 pages and covered about six boxes. James Baldwin's file covered one huge box. Anais Nin's file is one page, so it was just one page that came in a letter. Most of them look like interoffice memos from any corporation, only in this case, most on every page, without exception, 1 to 50 words are blacked out. And in certain cases, on certain pages, every single word is blacked out, and in certain cases, the page is not there at all, and they tell you a page is missing and that for security reasons, you can't even look at that page.
Now, you say that the FBI kept separate files for derogatory information about writers and separate files for obscene information, sexual right. information about writers. What was the purpose of keeping separate files?
Well, that was, I assumed, to blackmail people. For instance, Hoover kept a file called the obscene file, which, you know, any obscene material would go in there. He kept including information particularly about anyone that called him a homosexual. He was incensed by the possibility that the world would think of him this way and collected all the information about that.
So if you wanted to have an FBI file, all you really needed to do was mock or insult J. Edgar Hoover, yeah. and you'd have a file.
Yeah, that's a theme throughout the files that, for instance, Herman Wouk and James Gould Cousins, both of them were, you know, very conservative. But in two separate novels, they ridiculed FBI agents. Herman Wouk, in his case, I believe, he said that a FBI agent had gone to fat. James Gould Cousins, I think, referred to improperly to some detainment methods used by FBI agents. And in James Gould Cousins' case, Hoover not only wrote to the publisher, but he also wrote to the Book of the Month Club that was reprinting it, demanding an apology, and in addition wrote to the reviewers of the book. And in fact, one reviewer, Irita Van Doren, had a file started as a result of her review of that book.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Natalie Robbins, author of the new book Alien Inc., The FBI's War on Freedom of Expression. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Natalie Robbins is my guest, and through the Freedom of Information Act, she has received FBI files on hundreds of writers. She requested the files as research for her new book, Alien Inc., The FBI's War on Freedom of Expression. There are several different periods of FBI investigations into writers that you document in your book. One period starts in the mid-1940s when the FBI started its PR campaign to impress upon Americans the seriousness of the Red Menace. So which writers did the FBI target during that period, the Red Menace period?
In the 40s, there were 34 files started in the 40s. The period where the most files were opened, of course, is the 60s, where 250 were opened.
Sure, and this is the period of the Civil Rights
right.
Movement, the anti-war movement, and the women's movement.
And in the 30s, the period, there were 64 files opened. But you have to remember that part of the reason that the files got bigger in the 40s is that, and well, it actually began in the mid-30s and then into the 40s, of course, was because of the secret oral instructions that J. Edgar Hoover received from the most liberal president in American history, FDR. In 1934, Hoover received orders from FDR to track Nazis. That was a legitimate executive order. But in 1936, and then again 2 years later in 1938, FDR gave secret oral instructions to Hoover to investigate all subversive activities, including communism, and this became Hoover's ticket to increase his files, increase his power, and to become, as I call him in my book, the great enforcer.
In the 60s, I think Hoover particularly targeted writers who were involved in the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the
yes.
peace movement. Did he particularly go after black writers?
Yes, he did. Hoover was a racist. And I trace in my book that this really began in 1917 in Jack London's file. There's an item in that file that indicates that the Bureau believed that any action having to do with race relations or equality with black and white had a subversive component. And that's the earliest indication that this was true. It proceeded to 1920 when a paper was written about Negro activities in America, and then in 1925, Langston Hughes' file was opened, and then in 1936, Richard Wright's file was opened, and then I believe in 51, it was James Baldwin, and then in the early 60s, Amiri Baraka. Now, to understand Hoover's rage at the anti-war activists as well as the civil rights workers in the 60s, you have to understand that for Hoover, writers were just another group of aliens to be controlled and rounded up and dismissed. And the writers and activists of the 60s reminded him of what he referred to as the dreaded aliens of America's teen years. And Hoover's very first job in the Bureau was in 1917 to 1918. He was head of the Alien Enemy Bureau. And I believe that's a job title that he never left, that from 1917 to 1971, when he died, he was always head of the Alien Enemy Bureau and saw people he disagreed with, people that had attitudes or looked different in appearance. He thought of them as aliens, and writers were just another group of aliens.
Do you know when the FBI officially stopped keeping files on writers that it considered to be subversive?
The last file on an American writer that's documented in my book is E.L. Doctorow's file, which was begun in 1968. There are no others beyond that date.
Was that official policy to stop opening up files on writers?
68 was a little early for it to be official policy because the guidelines didn't really get started till the early 70s after Hoover's death, and then stringent guidelines were created. And in fact, there's two interesting things about those guidelines. One is that an agent I interviewed for my book and who appears throughout my book, and I refer to him as FBI Agent X, said that the guidelines, whatever they are and however stringent they are, would not stop him from conducting the kind of investigation he wanted to conduct. And you can read into that what you wish. And secondly, in my interview with Director Sessions in the late 80s, he said the FBI is not keeping files on writers because they're writers. And I believe him.
One of the writers who you found out had a file on them was your husband, the New York Times book critic Christopher Lehmannhaupt. Did he know there was a file before you started writing this book?
No. He found out about it when I found the document in someone's file, I don't remember whose it was at the moment, that and saw his name listed with a check mark next to it, which indicates indexing. In his case, I believe it was a document he signed in defense of Eldridge Cleaver.
I think it's only fitting to end this interview with an anecdote about Hoover as a writer. Now, Hoover wrote a book called Masters of Deceit, and I believe it was 1958. And one of the things you found out is the FBI helped make that book a bestseller.
Right. They bought up many copies. They encouraged agents to buy copies. And as a special agent once wrote somewhere, the FBI could make a bestseller out of a calculus textbook.
Well, Natalie Robbins, I thank you very much for sharing some of your research with us.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Natalie Robbins is the author of Alien Inc., The FBI's War on Freedom of Expression. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, something completely different. The United States is apparently going to buy some secret space equipment from Russia. The Topaz Space Power Unit and some thrusters are coming from the Soviet Union to the United States. We're going to talk about the candidates and whether all of the candidates are being treated in the same way by the press. There's the possibility that all of the breast implant lawsuits against Dow Corning may be grouped together in a class action suit. We'll talk about how more money is needed to bail out the SNLs. Tuberculosis is spreading again at dangerous levels in some states, and we have a money-saving idea for the movie industry.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A couple of years ago, we recorded an excerpt of David Cale's performance piece, Deep in a Dream of You. Since then, he's taken it around the country and is now performing it in San Francisco. We thought we'd take this opportunity to play it for you. David Cale once wanted to be a singer, but when that didn't happen, he started doing readings of lyrics he'd written. The lyrics evolved into monologues with different characters. As you'll hear, he still uses music. Deep in a Dream of You is about characters haunted by memories of relationships they can't let go of.
I will never forget watching you on the patio next to that lake in New Hampshire, doing the Jane Fonda workout to a Philip Glass record. How the wind blew the music across the lake, the blue fir trees surrounding the water barely moving at all. There was one cloud in the sky. Stretching your pale limbs into unnatural positions and holding them there. I read it somewhere that when the body dies, the soul leaves through the top of the head. I remember seeing my grandfather's body laid out in my grandmother's front room and thinking his body looked like a shell and automatically wondering, where's the soul gone? And instinctively looking up at the ceiling, as if I was going to see it hovering there. I will never forget the times I craved you, couldn't get enough of you, wanted you so bad it made my stomach ache. The times I was embarrassed by your displays of physical affection, worried about how it would look, embarrassed to be wanting you or something, feeling that you weren't pretty enough, when that was ludicrously some reflection on me, or that I needed to be with someone beautiful in a superficial way to somehow increase my own worth. I used to dream of being driven at night by an anonymous driver along an American highway. No words, just to be staring out the window like some garbo creature, moody and silent and deep inside myself. When we drove through Pennsylvania that night, I thought this may not be it, but it's pretty close. In the night, the lake looked like it had died. You wondered if what you wanted in another person was really what you would like to be yourself. The trees made sounds. When you shouted, your voice echoed in the mountains. You could duet with yourself. I will never forget flying in that plane over Boston in the middle of the night with a black coffee in one hand, trying to figure out how I could feel something so strongly, then stop feeling it altogether and considering that it was gone for good. I will never forget the look on your face when you tell me how you felt and how the words wouldn't leave me because I felt absolutely nothing. I didn't realize I had such a vicious streak till you were kind to me. I will never forget how soft the skin on your back was. I will never forget how you laughed at anything I said. I will never forget how I never believed you when you said I looked good, or what I did was good. Thinking that you were so in love that you would say anything to please me, that your opinion was invalid. When nothing makes sense, there's always sense of humor. I will never forget that joke you told me about Ginger Rogers. When asked how much she weighed, Ginger replied 145 pounds, 133 without makeup. How every time you told it, you cracked yourself up. I will never forget how one of your teeth was blue. I will never forget how when you danced, it looked like someone else had taken you over. I will never forget meeting your mother for the first time and the look on her face that seeing the two of us together was in some way confirming her most unsettling suspicions. I will never forget how meticulous you were, I will never forget that horrible cologne you wore. I will never forget you saying very quietly, I'm not living for anyone else's benefit. I will never forget one day realizing I knew nothing about you. I will never forget seeing you laying in that anonymous hospital, in the bed, with your eyes focused on something that I couldn't see. I will never forget you laying there asleep, still with your eyes wide open. I will never forget after visiting you in the hospital how I sobbed uncontrollably on the telephone and felt relieved afterwards that I could feel something for someone aside from myself. I will never forget leaving that room and knowing I wouldn't see you again. But I will never forget when you finished doing that exercise all those years ago, how the music kept playing. You came up behind me, touched my neck so gently with your lips, miles from anyone. The blue fir trees still, the water quiet, the one cloud moving very slightly, our chests rising, hearts floating across the lake, over the trees, up into the single cloud. How it moved into the distance, still beating. And you whispered, this is what it's all about. This is what it's all about.
David Cale performing an excerpt of Deep in a Dream of You. He's performing the show in San Francisco at the Life on the Water Theater through April 12th. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Sue Spolin, Sue Weinstein, and Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two nations, black and white, separate, hostile, and unequal. Professor Andrew Hacker says that in spite of civil rights laws, black and white America are growing further apart. Also, journalist Vernon Loeb on his recent travels through Thailand, Burma, and Bangladesh. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Breezy with a high of 55. Stay tuned for All Things Considered next.